Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, your NPR station in the Lehigh Valley. I'm John Pierce, along with Neil Heaver today doing our board work. And we are really interested to have as our guests today Dr. Ben Carter, who is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Muhlenberg College, and Megan Van Ravensway, who is Director of the Moravian Historical Society. Megan, where is that located?
We are in beautiful downtown Nazareth, Pennsylvania.
All right. What a nice town. Well, Megan is the Director of the Historical Society in Nazareth, which is the third oldest historical society in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Megan, do you know the number one and two?
Well, number one is down in Philadelphia, and it's an offshoot of Benjamin Franklin's. It's a historical society that evolved a very long time ago, I believe in 1737. And the second, of course, is the Historical Society of Pennsylvania down in Philadelphia.
So Philly gets one and two, yep. Nazareth gets three.
Exactly.
Hey, that's not bad. So Megan has served in this position for 3 years and has 8 years of professional museum experience. She holds a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Building Arts from the Savannah College of Arts and Design with a focus on historic preservation and architectural history. Megan, the term building arts as a bachelor's degree, fine arts in building arts. I never heard that before.
Well, I have to give a shout out to my alma mater. SCAD is a wonderful school that has many different disciplines. And so the building arts was historic preservation, interior design, architecture, and I think furniture design was also in there.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And so SCAD, for those of us who are not too familiar, is Savannah College of Arts and Design.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Megan envisions a new era for the Moravian Historical Society, expanding its relevance through exciting new programming, exhibitions, and research. And she's going to talk to us a little bit about that during our time together this evening. One of her most important initiatives is History is Calling, a $3 million five-year capital campaign to renovate and restore the 275-year-old property and buildings maintained by the society in Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that is ambitious. Dr. Ben Carter is an archaeologist and assistant professor of anthropology at Muhlenberg College. Now, Ben, you are an archaeologist. How do you happen to be assistant professor of anthropology?
I'm glad you asked, John.
he says.
No, this is actually... We just wrapped up classes, and this is one of the things that I actually talk about on the first day with pretty much all of my classes, and also on the last day, about how important it is that archaeology is actually a subdiscipline of anthropology. So I'm in an anthropology program, and I'm there with cultural anthropologists as well as physical anthropologists. So the broader question that we're all interested in is the humans. So that's archaeology, you know, when it's in history departments, when it's in classics departments, they're focused on those questions that classicists are interested in. What we're interested in as a broad discipline, anthropology is the study of humans, which is obviously a very broad definition. And so archaeology, as part of that, I'm continually interacting with cultural anthropologists, with physical anthropologists, to get a holistic perspective on the human past and present.
Right. And when I think of archaeology and anthropology, I think of the past. I think of way long ago. Now, does anthropology, you said it's study of humans, so we're still around.
Oh, yes. Most cultural anthropologists study modern humans. So... whether they're in the United States, Western Europe, but traditionally anthropologists are known for going to non-Western countries, places studying small-scale society, et cetera.
Many of which we haven't heard before. Yes,
right, exactly.
So Dr. Carter earned his PhD at Washington University in St. Louis. His research has taken him to Honduras, Ecuador, Peru, and then back here to St. Louis, Maine, and the Lehigh Valley. His research interests range from the production and exchange of objects made from the S word.
Spondylus.
Spondylus. How do we spell it?
S-P-O-N-D-Y-L-U-S.
Okay. It's a shellfish that is also known as Inca red gold in South America to early Euro-American pioneers in Maine, the ones who went east instead of west. I love that expression. That's Ben's.
Very few people know that there are pioneers who went east instead of going west.
We never think of that.
No. So that's who I study.
However, what excites him the most is providing opportunities for his students to get out of the classroom. Ben, how dare you not consider the classroom as sacrosanct?
That's why I teach, so I can get out of the classroom.
And all I say to that is, amen, brother. I agree totally with you. Megan, let's talk a little bit about the Moravian Historical Society and the History is Calling campaign.
Sure. Well, you have already mentioned, and something that we're extremely proud of, is that we are the third oldest historical society in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And when I hear that, I think about we were one of the oldest collecting entities in this area. So what that means is our museum collection is incredibly diverse. Our mission is to share and preserve the story of the Moravians. Why are they in the Lehigh Valley? Why are they founding Bethlehem and Nazareth? And what is this culture that they've established here for us today that's still around? So we talk about that through art, through their music, through their writings, through their documentation. So the museum is open 7 days a week, and we love to share this story with everybody. You know, this isn't just, for Moravians or history lovers. We try to make this relatable to everyone. So the museum's open 7 days a week. We welcome people to come up anytime to visit with us. We just started doing walking tours in Nazareth, too. So we truly understand that people want to relate with history in their own way. So you can choose to go on a self-guided tour, or you can hang out with one of our docents and enjoy a visit through the museum. So we're proud of the museum. We own 3 acres in beautiful downtown Nazareth. And most importantly, our two largest things that we take care of are our oldest, our buildings. We maintain the Gray Cottage and the Whitfield House. And those are the oldest Moravian structures in all of North America. We're very proud of that. The collection is phenomenal. And, of course, our research capabilities are phenomenal, too, for anyone who wants to come in and peruse the collection more intimately. But what we found about a year and a half to 2 years ago now was we truly have some deferred maintenance on site, as most museums do. There's very little state and local funding, so some things went by the wayside, and it's time now that we start taking care of it, so to speak. So we have about 25 years to catch up on. As mentioned, that 3 acres is stunning. We have countless 75 to 100-year-old trees that we need to take care of, and we really need to think about how the guests are interacting with these historic structures. So the History is Calling campaign. It's a 5-year campaign, and it's phased, what's most important first, up to sort of our wish list.
Are you just beginning that campaign now?
We have completed phase one. Phase one was sort of a triage, meaning, what needs to be taken care of first. So we went through, and the Gray Cottage is about to get a new roof on her. The Whitfield House's roof just had some serious repairs as well. And there's a lot of groundwork. And, of course, the archaeology was the first thing that we started with.
Sounds like the State Theater in Easton, where they're also in a campaign for a new roof. It rains in this area. We have to have solid roofs. Megan, where were you before you came to Nazareth?
Before Nazareth, I was down in Savannah, Georgia, and I was, of course, learning how to understand what a building needs and what a museum entity is. So I was down in school.
So it's studying. Mm-hmm. And so this is your first position outside after you finished your studies?
It is not. I had some time with Historic Bethlehem Partnership here in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
All right. Ben, how did you get involved with the museum, the Historical Society in Nazareth?
It was definitely a bit of luck. Two things were happening basically at the same time. As Megan mentioned, they were starting to plan some initial tests and renovations at the Whitfield House, at the tract that the Moravian Historical Society owns. At the same time, every other fall, I run a class called Field Archaeology. And the purpose of that is, like I mentioned, we discussed before, is to get students who have learned about archaeology and sort of the importance and interacting with community stakeholders, et cetera, to get them out and actually do it. I have, in the past, let's see, in 2010 and 2012, we actually worked on a Moravian site in Lehighton called Gnadenhütten. And we can talk about that a little bit more later, but it was the site of an important massacre in 1755. So, but those excavations actually didn't turn out so well. It's a site that it no longer is visible, so we were trying to find it, and we used a number of different techniques to do that, and were actually unable to relocate it, which I still don't understand. I still want to go back. I still want to do more, but because we hadn't found anything, I needed a new project, right? And I contacted a number of people sort of throughout the valley to see who was interested and what possibilities there might be. And by and far above anybody else, the Moravian Historical Society seemed to be the one that was the most interested and the most willing to sort of deal with, people digging in their front yard for an entire semester.
Was Megan already on board with them when you made your approaches?
Yes. So at the same time, while the Moravian Historical Society was planning Megan mentions the sort of triage, which triage often involves roofs, right? Got to protect what's inside. But they're also planning on doing some landscaping, some remodeling of the landscape. And what that entails often is moving dirt. And when you move dirt, archaeologists get very nervous because when you move dirt, you often move what's underneath the dirt, and there's often a lot more than you think underneath there. So in the early stages, I was involved peripherally, but involved in the conversation about this, and I encouraged them as much as I possibly could to do archaeology. And I like to think I had some influence on that. So at the same time, those two things are going on. Clearly, doing some archaeology and my class are two very different things. What they needed to sort of test what impact their landscaping might have on archaeological resources is very different than what I can do with students. And I think it was probably very clear once the contract archaeologists began working, they work way faster than I can, right? My students, I encourage them to be very careful and work very slow, and professional archaeologists know what they're doing, and right. So can work a lot faster. So those two things came together sort of at the perfect time. And we started talking about it, and we decided to do something. I think it was still open for quite some time, but in the end, we were able to excavate for an entire semester at the Moravian Historical Society.
Wow, and that was 3 years ago?
Well, the conversation, I think, happened probably started about a year ago.
I would say so.
Mm-hmm. Right. Roughly speaking.
And the class just wrapped up this past semester.
And Megan, what role did you play in as far as the students from Muhlenberg were concerned?
Cheerleader. I loved having them on the property. Again, we love the students coming out and actively learning. It, of course, behooved us because we were learning from the areas that they were digging in as well. As Ben mentioned, we hired a professional archaeology team to come in and do a full program, presentation plan for us, where Ben was able to take his class and focus in on one aspect of the property. So that was exciting. We felt like it got a little bit more attention than what the professionals did. But it was great for us, and we adore Muhlenberg College, so it was really important for us to strengthen that relationship too.
It's wonderful to see the relationships of different institutions mm-hmm. in the Lehigh Valley.
And I'll stress how important that is, John. The Moravian Historical Society you know, has sort of been open to involving us all along, but they also made decisions that made it much easier for us to be involved. Mm. For example, getting professional archaeologists, just having an idea of what's in the soil before we start excavating is extremely important, right? And they're professional, so they can, they, you know, I would talk to the principal investigator was Jim Lee from Hunter Research down in Trenton, New Jersey, and I'd ask him, you know, we'd talk about what he's found, and I could use that information to base my excavation on what, you know, what would I expect, how long would it take, et cetera, how deep were the materials. And I think that probably the most exciting thing that Megan and the Moravian Historical Society did was they did ground penetrating radar. And so you'll probably hear me mention it later on as GPR. So that's what I'm talking about. And what it is it's a device. It looks kind of like a wheelbarrow, right? Uh-huh. And they drag it across the property, and it shoots a radar signal down into the ground, and that bounces off different things in different ways. And it will, the readings that come out, a professional has to read these readings, and it will show you where objects are in the ground. So, and it will, it, what it tells you is where the radar bounces off differently. So if you've just got soil, right, it will give you a certain signal. And then if you pass over a stone wall underneath that soil, it will bounce back and give you a different signal. It will give you a different signal if you've dug a trench and filled it back in, right? The soil's been disturbed. It's slightly different than the soil around it, et cetera.
So are those signals specific that you would know it's a wall or a ditch, or is it just different from being ordinary dirt?
No, the way it comes back, the way it reflects is how hard the surface is. It will reflect it back more immediately. A trench that's been filled back in is much more difficult to identify than a stone wall. Stone walls will just sort of, boom, jump out at you. So that's one of the reasons why you need a professional to actually read. The data looks very confusing. If you and I were to look at it, we'd just see a bunch of squiggly black lines.
Okay. It would be interesting to follow someone for a few minutes and watch how that happens.
It was very neat.
I was going to say, Megan, you probably did.
I did.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. We have the fascinating subject of archaeology today. And our guests are Dr. Ben Carter, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Muhlenberg College, and Megan Van Ravensway, who is Director of the Moravian Historical Society in Nazareth. Time to take a break. We will be right back.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Zollner Art Center, presenting Buddy, the Buddy Holly story, now in its 25th year. Buddy opened in London's West End in 1989 and continues to perform on tour around the world. Buddy tells the story of Buddy Holly through his short career and features the classic songs Peggy Sue, That'll Be the Day, Not Fade Away, and more. Coming to Zollner on Saturday, January 17th at 8 p.m. for one night only. For more information, 610-7LU Arts or zollnerartcenter.org.
Our topic this evening is archaeology and the Historical Society in Nazareth. Our guests, Dr. Ben Carter and Megan Van Ravensway, who cooperate in discovering more than just what's on top of the ground, Megan, as it turns out. We heard the, should give a little quiz to see if our listeners were paying attention. We had GPR come up in our first segment, and that is ground penetrating radar. Megan, take us back to your getting in touch with professional archaeologists. And how did that all happen?
Well, as Ben mentioned, we were also, part of our capital campaign is doing a lot of manipulation of the ground. We want to move walkways. We want to move our parking lot. So it was important at this very beginning step for us to understand the story that was taking place under the ground. We certainly wouldn't put the parking lot in a very sensitive space. So we wanted to find exciting things underground, and then we also didn't want to find some exciting things underground. So in order to do that, to start everything off, we needed to contract, which we did, an archaeological firm to come out and do a whole assessment for us. We ended up hiring Hunter Research Incorporated. They're out of Princeton, New Jersey, and they were just fantastic to us. The very first step of the project was ground penetrating radar. And that was thrilling. You know, I often joke, if you were calling the Whitfield House for about a 2-week period a few months ago and nobody answered, it was because we were all outside hovering over the archaeologist. But what he did is just literally went inch by inch, foot by foot, over our entire 3 acres and ran a radar through it.
How long did all that take for him to do?
I want to say it took him about 2 weeks of very solid days.
Inching along.
It was incredible.
Just like being on Route 22.
Pretty much. But it was incredible.
And John, I'll just jump in here for a second, because I think you have to realize how important this is. The Moravian Historical Society, by doing this, has taken a view that not many historical societies do. They've recognized that they're going to impact the landscape and that there's something under there. Often people don't think about what is underneath the ground. And so just the fact that they considered doing archaeology is thrilling. The fact that they did it and did GPR. GPR literally gives you a window into the ground. Is very exciting and very unusual.
Well, thank you, Ben. And I wish that we could somehow show your viewers the image of the plan that came back to us. But what we did, I liken it to lasagna, where the archaeologist truly gave us a view of the levels and the layers of history under the ground. So we saw colonial period foundations, and then there was the Victorian period levels. And then we could see when a lot of groundwork was done and they leveled off some area of the property. So it's this view from overhead, and you can see where there were foundations and where there were privies and where there was just, you know, many different activities on the ground. You could see the heavily trodden walkways from building to building. You could see old wagon trails. It was phenomenal.
Were these images that you could see without disturbing the ground?
Right. That radar is what was creating all these images. And once, you know, as Ben kind of mentioned, it looked like an ultrasound to me. I you can't make sense of it. But when they, you know, clean it up and they give you a presentation of your whole property, you can see the lines. And we were able to rectify that with existing maps that were drawn of the property. So we were able to coincide that with where we knew buildings were. But
meanwhile, you're hoping that they will not find so much all over your property that you can't put in a parking lot and walkways.
Well, we got really lucky. We, of course, had them test where we want the parking lot and where we want our amphitheater, et cetera. And those areas of the land had nothing under them. So somebody was looking out for us. We're very pleased with that. But we were also pleased to find some significant findings. Most notably, we found the first house of Nazareth. This was a structure that was created in 1740, and it's where the Moravians had temporary refuge that they built while they were building the very large Whitfield House. If you've never visited the Whitfield House, it is massive. It's built of limestone, and they needed to quarry it. So before they did that, they created a very quick building built out of logs, and it did have a stone basement. It was torn down in 1864, and so there's no photographs of it. There's only some drawings of it. And we sort of knew where it was, but with this ground-penetrating radar, they were able to find it. So getting back to that plan, the archaeologist came back to us and made a recommendation of 25 hot spots, of spots where they wanted to do test pits and dig. Of course, the first house, we did that. We also dug up several privies and I would say multiple wells and all sorts of different anomalies, as they called them. And then the exciting challenge of a French and Indian War period stockade arose. We know that there was a stockade around the building and the complex several different times over the French and Indian War period. And so that's what we handed over to Dr. Ben Carter in his class, was to dig to see if they could find evidence of that French and Indian War period stockade.
All right. Big project. Huge project.
Yes, it is. And the amount of time and effort put into this, John, I think is admirable. So my role in this was to look into the stockade. Now let's sort of back up a little bit. One of the most important aspects of the Moravian mission to the Americas was missionizing. One of their main goals, if not the main goal, was to missionize. And most of that, it wasn't limited to Native Americans, but that was probably their most important missions were with Native Americans. And so my interest in this largely stems from initial interest in Gnadenhütten, which was one of these missions where there was then a subsequent massacre. Now, the massacre was perpetrated by, as far as we know, of course, you have to question some of the accounts, but as far as we know, was actually perpetrated by Native Americans against Moravians, and 11 people were killed in that massacre.
And say again, Gnadenhütten.
Gnadenhütten. Which means huts of grace, or abodes of grace, if you will. So that was up in Lehighton, along the Mahoning Creek. And so my interest in that is I'm very interested in the relationship and how different cultures affect each other. And so that's sort of the syncretism that develops when two very, very different cultures are living in the same space. So again, I want to go back to Gnadenhütten and find it. But for the time being, I'm interested in what's going on with this relationship. So as the one thing to remind your listeners is that the relationship was not actually bad between Native Americans and Moravians. However, at the same time, relationships between Euro-Americans generally and Native Americans broadly were falling apart. You know, this was post Walking Purchase was 1737, you know, which basically, you know, a large part of eastern Pennsylvania was taken from Native Americans sort of by way of a trick.
Tell us about that trick.
So the trick was, and I'm not going to remember the date, there was an initial treaty back in the 1600s, 1680s, I think. We think, actually, that's what was said. We're not actually sure that treaty existed. But and the treaty basically said that Penn was purchasing, this is William Penn, was purchasing a tract of land that was delimited by, was it 24 hours? 24 hours of walking. So if you walked from a certain point to another, and the line would be where that person walked after 24 hours. And then the line would go due east from there. So it was a fairly large chunk of sort of eastern Pennsylvania. Number one, we're not sure that that treaty ever really existed. We don't actually have a document that says this. But the trick was that they took specialized scouts. So the Pennsylvanians took a couple of scouts who were very fast runners, could travel long distance, and they also pre-cut the trail. In other words, they didn't just let them run through the woods. They pre-cut the trail so that it was basically a straight shot. And these guys ran, you know, nonstop for, I forget if it was 24 hours or even longer.
Uh-huh.
But what that meant was that the land that had been quote unquote sold in this treaty was actually a much larger chunk of land than originally intended. So there's that was actually just one early component. And as time goes on, as you go into the 1740s and 1750s, more and more land is sold, quote unquote, sold to Europeans by Native Americans, or, you know, the opposite translation is that it was largely stolen.
Taken from them.
Largely taken. And so as Native Americans are pushed around, both by Pennsylvania, by the sort of government in Philly, which, by the way, was not William Penn at this point, it was his children. And they're also being pulled by the Iroquois. the Six Nations up in upstate New York, and who sort of want to draw them back into their sphere of influence. So there's sort of two imperial powers, right? The Iroquois and Philadelphia trying to pull the Delaware towards them. And this is going on throughout eastern Pennsylvania. Actually, it's going on well into western Pennsylvania as well. And what this results in is a very strong shift in Native American, Euro-American relationships along the frontier. Early on, the historians talk about a frontier of inclusion, where early settlers actually got along very well with Native Americans. Let's not make this sound too rosy, right? We've got two very different people, two very different color cultures. They had their issues. But generally speaking, they were, in space, they were closely associated. And so therefore, generally speaking, got along fairly well. However, as these imperial powers start to pull them, stuff happens, and there are murders, et cetera, and it becomes racialized, right? And so then it's sort of Native Americans versus whites. Before that, it wasn't. Honestly, it was more of sort of civilized Philadelphia versus those uncivilized settlers. Oh, yeah, and those Native Americans too, right? And so as the community, as this shift happens, there are a number of massacres, really sort of atrocious things on both sides, happening on both sides. Often we hear about Native Americans committing atrocities against Euro-Americans, but it certainly was going both ways and some pretty grisly stuff going on. And in the middle of that, you have Moravians who have, from the beginning, gotten along very well with Native Americans. Now, of course, they're trying to missionize them, so they're trying to convert them. But the Moravians missionized in a very different way. It was not in your face. They tried to go and sort of convince or talk to people about Jesus and their sort of conception of Jesus, and then sort of back off. And when people were ready, they would come to them. So they had a lot of, you know, it was very sort of a gentle missionizing. And there were plenty of Native Americans, however, who found that interesting and attractive. And they found being associated with this certain group of Euro-Americans attractive for economic purposes, for political purposes, et cetera. So the Gnadenhütten especially was a fairly large and relatively peaceful island in a developing sort of sea of violence. And so that's what I'm interested in Gnadenhütten for that reason, but I'm also interested in Nazareth for that reason and the stockade. So Moravians were, generally speaking, were nonviolent. As a matter of fact, one of their initial settlements was actually down in Georgia, and they were kicked out because they wouldn't fight against the Spanish. So then they came to Pennsylvania. And so they're nonviolent, so they're not going to fight against Native Americans, but one of the things that they do almost, within a month of the Gnadenhütten massacre is put up stockades. And let me clarify for your listeners, too, what a stockade is. It's basically you cut down a bunch of trees and put them in a big, long trench, side by side, sticking straight up, often, you know, sort of stereotypically with pointed, somewhere. So that stockade, if we could find it, if we could relocate it in Nazareth, then we could have a much better sort of idea, or at least it's one little component of this relationship between Native Americans and Euro-Americans, and especially between Moravians and local Native Americans.
Fascinating history. This is Dr. Ben Carter, who is explaining to us about Moravians' activities, and particularly their relationships with Native Americans in Pennsylvania. And, of course, William Penn comes into the equation, as do his children later on. And this pull, that's fascinating, between the Iroquois and Philadelphia, as you put it. And also Megan Van Ravensway, who is talking to us about what's going on nowadays at the Moravian Historical Society in Nazareth. And when we come back from our break, Megan, we want to talk a little bit about what people would see in the museum, why should we go there? And Ben, why do we care so much about the past anyway? Aren't we a country looking forward, looking toward the future? So is history the man who stands at the rear of the boat, and when the boat hits a rock, he says, well, we hit another one? Is that unkind to historians?
Should I go ahead and answer that, or should we go on break?
Give us a short answer.
I'll give you a short answer. I mean, the stock answer is, you know, if you don't study history, you're doomed to repeat it. I'm not sure I actually buy that. However, what we are today is largely fashioned in the historic past. Mm. You know, what Nazareth is, what Bethlehem is. Bethlehem and Nazareth, you can see it. I mean, the thing I like about archaeology, you can literally see it imprinted on the landscape. So all the old houses, right? Where did those houses come from? Well, if you want to know, you got to go into history.
And if you want to turn to introspection, why are we the way we are today, mm-hmm. you have to
Absolutely.
Go back to history for that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're having a fascinating discussion here with Dr. Ben Carter and Megan Van Ravensway. We will return after a brief break, so stay with us.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Galicia, and Brittany, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Bringing you music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 on WDIY Allentown listener-supported community public radio.
Our topic this evening is archaeology, and particularly in the Nazareth area. Our guest, Dr. Ben Carter, who is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Muhlenberg College, and Megan Van Ravensway, who is Director of the Museum Moravian Historical Society in Nazareth. We have already talked about the museum, Meg and Megan, and do I know her well enough to say Meg? Do people call you Meg?
My very close friends, yes. And now I'm glad to say you're one of
Thank
them.
Thank you. I am now one of them. All right. Sorry I don't do Facebook, or we could be in contact
every
daily.
Day.
So I'd like to ask if for people who have not been to the museum, what are the hours?
We are open 7 days a week, 1 to 4.
And when we go to the museum, what do we see?
Well, first off, you get access into the Whitfield House. And the Whitfield House began construction in 1740, and they finished it in 1743. So I think it's just an exquisite example of Germanic colonial architecture. So first off, I love the building. But when you come in, you'll, of course, visit our second floor, which is our permanent exhibition. And that exhibition features highlights of who the Moravians were and are. Why are they here in North America? Why are they here particularly in Pennsylvania? And again, getting back to the music, the art, and the culture. So some highlights, of course, include we have a phenomenal collection of missions-related objects. As Dr. Carter mentioned, the Moravians are here in the New World to preach Christianity. And they, of course, loved decorative arts. So when they would go visit a tribe or another community, they might bring objects back. And we have this exquisite collection of tribal art at the museum spanning all over the world, pieces from Tibet, from Africa, et cetera. So we're excited by that. And then, of course, we get into the decorative arts that the Moravians, you know, people often ask us, were they like the Amish? And I always say, well, I'm not an Amish specialist, but I understand the Amish lived simply in God And I always say that the Moravians lived exuberantly in God. They loved their decorative arts. They loved to paint. They loved their music. They loved just drinking and food. They were really a very exuberant people. So we talk about the decorative arts of the Moravians and, you know, some of the case clocks that are just exquisite and paintings, etc. And then, of course, we talk about music, that the Moravians feel still today that the Word of God comes through music. So some notable pieces are we have an exquisite trombone collection. The Moravians are attributed with being the first to bring the trombone to the New World. And then most notably, of course, is the Antes violin, which is the oldest known American-made violin in existence that's on display. And then, of course, you can't be in Nazareth and not talk about Martin guitar. So we have an exquisite Martin guitar on display as well. But then we get more into the music with an organ that was built in 1776 for the Brethren's House here in Bethlehem. And then we get into education and science and technology and industry. Currently on display is also an electricity machine. I kind of giggle when I look at it. It's from the Brethren's House in Bethlehem. And we weren't initially sure why these single men are making an electricity machine. Is it for medicinal purposes? Was it just to understand science? What was it? But it's phenomenal if you think a late 18th century electricity machine is just on display. It's phenomenal. So we hope you'll come and explore the permanent collection. Just about 2 weeks ago, we opened our newest exhibition called The Ephrata Tract, Where Nazareth Began. And that's in honor of our 275th birthday of Nazareth, which is next year in 2015. So we created an exhibition, as Ben was talking about, bringing the Moravians here to Pennsylvania. And yes, the walking purchase happened, but there was one American Indian tribe just a stone's throw away, and how did the Moravians relate to them? And we actually have the deeds from the Penn brothers for that actual property in Nazareth. They sold the property to their sister. Their sister sold it to William Allen, and then William Allen eventually went on to sell it to George Whitfield, and hence the Whitfield House. The Moravians are coming here to Pennsylvania to help Whitfield build a school. So it's a phenomenal exhibition. It goes through the whole story about what was the first house, what is the Gray Cottage, what is the Whitfield House, some leading figures in its period of history, and people who really helped save the structures. And then, of course, we get into the important story about why on earth does the Moravian Historical Society care for all this? And we're coming in 1857 to be the caretakers of this property, and we have been until then, of course. And then we start talking about our campaign, why the campaign is so important. So we're taking you from the very start in the exhibition all the way to the future. And, of course, that gets us right back to the Capital campaign. And we hope soon to display some of the archaeological objects that were pulled from under the ground.
The campaign is a year old by this time. It's a five-year campaign. $3 million is what you're looking for. And how could people who are listening contribute to the campaign?
Well, we will shortly be going live, so to speak, with the campaign. We're in the silent phase where we're getting some investors involved, et cetera, some sponsors involved and donors. But anybody who would like to contribute, we would greatly appreciate that. They could certainly just jump onto the website, MoravianHistoricalSociety.org, and at the bottom left there is a link to the Ephrata Tract Project and some information about how to donate. Or you could just give me a call.
All right. And the number to call is?
610-759-5070.
Very good. Megan, how much of your time would you say that you are on the clock at the museum is spent with fundraising?
200%.
Sounds like a college president, doesn't it, Ben?
It does.
No, we're very proud of the society and the partners that support us. Really just come to us, you know, with open arms. It's such a treasure, and not just for Moravians and history lovers, but for Nazareth itself. We really, truly want to be Central Park in Nazareth. You know, to have 3 acres right downtown, we need to be.
Exactly. Your enthusiasm for the Moravian history, culture, and so on is obvious.
Thank you.
On this interview. Did you have a particular interest in Moravians before you came to Nazareth, or has this developed since you came?
Oh, thank you for asking. Funny enough, I actually came from Savannah, Georgia, where the Moravians were before Pennsylvania, and I still had never heard of them. But no, I fell in love when I visited this area. I fell in love with Bethlehem and Nazareth and the Lehigh Valley. I think that this area is so exquisite, and we're so lucky to live here and have such a strong history. And of course, my love is with historic preservation and architectural history. So I fell in love.
And you're originally from Savannah?
I am.
Mm-hmm. What happened to your drawl?
We tuck it in, especially on radio, John.
So Ben, what else do we want to cover as far
well,
as...
Well, I think I should mention, you know, what we found. So the students worked... At the Moravian Historical Society for 7 Sundays. And I should give them a shout out because these are college students, and I made them get up and be ready in the van by 7:30 on Sunday morning. Very few people are up and on the van at 7:30, much less college students. So I was very proud of them. They did an amazing job. We dug 5 1-meter by 1-meter units, and we got down to about 0.5 meter each. Again, that's pretty slow for archaeology, but that's not bad for students and a very limited amount of time. What we were looking for was this stockade, and I should clarify for your listeners what that means. Obviously, the stockade is not still standing, otherwise we wouldn't need to dig and we wouldn't need to find it. But the GPR showed that there was a possible trench, a very large trench. And so we were going to confirm that. You have to remember that GPR, you know, it's messy, right? So you get a really good idea of what's under the ground, but it's imperfect. So we were going to excavate and find that trench. We were unable to find it. However, I think it's still there. It's just that we ran into a lot of really interesting stuff before we could even get there. We found there's really great stratigraphy. The layers of the soil at the site are really fascinating. We have the topsoil and then some soil after that. And then there's a layer of construction debris. So it's bricks and slate, et cetera, and lots of nails. We collected hundreds and hundreds of nails from this layer. And that's associated, I think, I'm not positive on this, I think it's related to the a back porch. Or a second entrance that was on the Whitfield house. And I think that was taken off sometime probably in the mid-1800s. We don't have a good date on that, but I think that's fairly good. Below that, we have this amazing layer that is just rich with artifacts. Hopefully, if I'm right about that construction debris, from between around 1850 to the late 1700s. And it is just chock full of ceramics. We have fragments of ceramic pipes. We have lots of buttons, interestingly enough, and lots of sewing tools, needles, thimbles, etc. Very little cooking utensils, so this is clearly sort of household debris, but not kitchen debris. And on the flip side of that, we have hundreds and hundreds of animal bones from this layer. Just massive quantities of very large animal bones. So one of the things that we need to do is study those animal bones. I'm not a faunal expert, so we need to get somebody else to do that. And then beneath that, right, we found a couple of stone walls. So we're now down a good 2 feet to convert from metric. We're down a good 2 feet, and we actually found the very tops of stone walls. And these stone walls are probably the outline to a rectangular structure about 3 feet by 6 feet. This is interesting, and this actually gets to, the GPR actually said that there was probably a circular structure here, right? So this gives you a good idea that the GPR identified something and it can give you some good information, but it was actually wrong on a couple of the details. Okay? And now what exactly is this? We don't know. It's capped, this structure, the interior of the structure is capped by plaster. So it was probably torn down, and the plaster fell on top of the foundation. It was filled in, and then the plaster was dropped on top of it. Inside that, we have a number of artifacts, and we only excavated just barely inside this. We have a number of artifacts from the late 1700s. So now we're really getting into the time period that we're most interested in. And of course, we found that stuff in the last day, which always happens on archaeological digs, right? The stuff you really wanted to get to, the most interesting thing happens on the last day. So we didn't get to sterile soil, which means that there are no artifacts. So we're still looking at continuing doing a little bit more work.
And you will continue to do that digging until you do find sterile soil?
Generally speaking, you're supposed to dig to sterile, right? So then you've made it through all of the material that's been affected by humans. And once you're in sterile, we don't really care. Geologists might care at that point, but we don't. We want the stuff that's associated with people. However, inside this structure, the GPR suggested that this structure might be around, the stone wall itself might be around 5 feet deep. So it may be a lot of material. It's extremely rich. There's lots of stuff right there at the top. So it literally could be a sort of a quote-unquote gold mine.
So far you've gone down 2 feet into the ground, and you would have another at least 5 feet to go down to try to uncover the original
potentially
structure.
Correct.
And that is, I find that when I think about archaeology and I see the pictures of people with tiny brushes, brushing off a little bit of a ceramic bowl or something, I'm thinking to myself, what tedious work this is.
It's tedious. It's very tedious. The students will tell you, though, that I think everybody becomes a bit of a punster and a bit sarcastic and a bit you're uncomfortable. You're laying on your stomach. You're sort of upside down. You're cramped. You're sitting on your feet. Everybody's uncomfortable. And actually, the students deal with it phenomenally well. And a lot of that comes out in joking. So it's actually a lot of fun. That has to do a lot with the people. But it also is really exciting as, you know, new artifacts come up. You're like, oh, you know, everybody gets excited about a new button, a new coin, et cetera. So we did actually find some coins actually in that demolition layer from the 1850s.
That's a fantastic experience for college students to have. Megan, in your studies, did you have such experiences?
I was. I was very lucky. We were very hands-on down in Savannah.
And did you do this kind of excavating?
I did not. So I was one of the people that was right over Ben's shoulder, watching every step of the way. And I think I started to annoy the professional hunter research. I think I was starting to annoy them by the end of it. It's just so exciting because, like Ben says, they pull up a bucket of soil and sift through it in their screen. And oh, my goodness. There's a piece of red clay tile roof that we know was on the first house. It's phenomenal.
No gold or silver?
No gold or silver. I try to avoid it as much as I possibly can, right? Because then you take risk with people stealing it and, you know, losing
the student,
it. And
the students are thinking, why aren't we out in California getting gold?
They actually, they're really fascinated by the fact by how much of history is literally sitting beneath your feet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so indeed. I think it's really very eye-opening to them, and I hope it's eye-opening sort of to the community as well. And I think I hope that it's also benefited the Moravian Historical Society and sort of letting them know what is actually underneath the ground at their site.
Well, I hope that our listeners have learned a lot, as your students do, too, about what is beneath the ground. At least theoretically, we can sort of start to picture how you get going with that. GPR is a new term for me. The ground penetrating radar, and it would be just really interesting to see that in operation. But Megan, let's give our listeners, before we have to leave here in a couple of minutes, let's give them one more time the hours of the museum and where it's located.
Sure. We are in downtown Nazareth. We are at 214 East Center Street. The museum is open 7 days a week from 1 to 4 p.m. And if anyone's interested in the archaeological work that has been going on and the campaign and other portions of it, they can certainly jump onto our website, which is MoravianHistoricalSociety.org. It's our goal to consistently offer public events for our members and non-members to learn about this. So one thing that Dr. Carter didn't mention was just recently we had a presentation by the students presenting objects that they found, and we're going to consistently do that. So if you'd like to jump onto our website and look at our calendar of events.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our two guests for being with us this evening, Dr. Ben Carter, who is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Muhlenberg College, One day it'll be associate Ben, though.
Thank you.
Megan Van Ravensway, who is director and has been for 3 years now of the Moravian Historical Society in Nazareth. And she made her way all the way to eclectic South Bethlehem to be with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
And remember, until we meet again, to be gentle with your neighbor. Good evening.